Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Barbara Edelman. Barbara Edelman's new chapbook of poetry, Exposure, was published by Finishing Line Press in July 2014. She teaches writing and literature at the University of Pittsburgh. Her poems have appeared in journals including Prairie Schooner, Poet Lore, Cimarron Review, and 5 AM. In translation in the Italian journal, Nuovi Argomenti, and in several anthologies. Her short prose has appeared in the journals Rattle and Arts and Letters. Edelman's chapbook, A Girl in Water, was published by Parallel Press at the University of Wisconsin Libraries in 2002. Her full-length manuscript, Dream of the Gone From City, was a finalist for the 2014 Lexi Rudnitsky First Book Prize from Persia Books. Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Good. How are you, Jan?
I'm good. Congratulations on your new chapbook.
Thank you.
Exposure. That's really exciting.
Thanks.
And it sounds like other things are happening, too, with your full-length book. It's getting close to publication, sounds like.
Oh, I hope that that's true. It was exciting to be a finalist.
Yeah. Okay, so you're going to start with something from your new chapbook.
Yes. This poem's called Tunnel Road. It starts with a little epigraph. Obsession is the opposite of creativity. If I look all day into a face that may be there or not there, I enter a tunnel. If I look all day into a face that is itself a tunnel, I enter a windowless room, B, a windowless room. There was so much snow that there was only snow, and spruce trunks blackened snow, and glide of Nordic skis on snow, and silence like a bridge of ice between two continents. There was a road called Tunnel Road we never found, a mated set of tracks we never saw, a warming hut we never reached, a fire inside the hut. At the hut we never reached, a man and woman park their skis and enter, to a wood stove, table, iron poker, axe, light through two small windows. She stokes the fire, he throws on logs. She takes off gloves, then boots. He watches her undress. He thinks each layer must be the last, but there's another and another. We drew two stories through the hush of woods, amid the faintest bird tracks, the iced rivulets, the hemlocks dressed as polar bears. We took turns burrowing through powder or gliding in the other's tracks. The snow was falling now, or circling, climbing. Our hair was filled with jewels, our tracks erasing. One story for my mother. That's not my stomach rumbling, it's yours. I didn't say that song reminds me of a truck backing up. That's a thought you created in my voice. I didn't say your shoulders remind me of the Washington Arch, but they do. And the arc inside the square is one story of your body. And your gait reminds me now of a truck backing up. And the ruby on your finger reminds me of a helium balloon I let go of in the St. Louis train station. I was 4. It rose to the top of the dome and stuck there like a ladybug. I read on the label of a soup can, memory is a divided tree. I remember words that floated in the dome of the station. I remember walking out without my red balloon into the slurry and the slush and seeing that a city's like a field of moving legs, where trains and buses rumble, like my stomach has been rumbling, like your thoughts have rumbled quietly in others' voices. Your thoughts are wonderful and many-colored. They've traveled like hot air balloons through all the years you've lived. Your voice is a divided tree. I've stood between its whole trunks, listening, roots to darken sky. North of Sunset, 1980s, in memory of Joel. We took disco lessons in a Malibu living room, open deck on the Pacific, double bass of surf on cliffs. I learned to lead from a follow position. Joel's lead was a ghost touch. his sense of rhythm hypothetical. I was the skirt, but he the ingenue, long lashes over violet eyes, closing on yet another sunset where even the homeless stayed warm by day. He almost went homeless, I heard, until friends took him in, through the end, his skin a bloom of violet. Sitting here, eating my heart out, waiting, waiting for some lover to call. Dialed about 1,000 numbers lately, almost yanked the phone off the wall. I held his fingers and twirled. He might have been a silk scarf, might have been a wife, a father, a mogul in a Rolls, likely not a dancer. But he disappeared. Whole birthday parties followed. Sometimes they fill my living room, their cadences and faces. Sun enough for all, though in Malibu it might be afternoon before the world assumes a shape. The fog hangs thick with tricks. Walk out into the long cloud of morning. The sea is thundering, as if above you, under you, and you can't tell where the shore drops off. Another poem from my mother. Go West. At 92, she'll move to Hollywood, shrugging off the ground of 7 decades, the dirt she worked, Midwestern fertile crescent of mispronounced Egyptian names, its cliffs and wooded hills, its lakes with their attendant herons, ducks, bald eagles that return to winter nests, the cardinals and finches at her feeder, the rows of corn and soy, and headstones. How much of this landscape is still active in her system? Her life in southern Illinois has shrunk to a few faces, fewer rooms, a pool, a list of numbers, humidity that holds her like a pair of arms, a chair looking out on a mown field, the visitations of the ruby-throated hummingbird. No one visits. Those who do talk too much, laugh at things that aren't funny. They don't enunciate. They inflect each statement as if it were a question. Go west, old woman. It's not her first migration. She typed her way through war in mucklucks on a Kodiak Island naval base, her flight from all that was familiar. The promise now is sunshine and blood. Her sons kick in like firemen, one to nudge her out, the other waiting with a net. Aloft, she circles ocean, freeways, mountains with their dirty skirts, the city's fabric stitched into the brown hem of sky in 3 directions. She wakes to a birdless world, to the strange drone of traffic, and to red clay roofs, to balconies of bougainvillea spilling over wrought iron. What do you remember, Vecchia, of the Mediterranean? I balconi, I tetti rossi come questi. There's music that isn't Christian, food that isn't fried, Tai Chi in wheelchairs, smatterings of Yiddish, performers just a step ball change from Broadway, orange trees and planters, their bright fruit ripe for the plucking by anybody who can reach. The pool is not a euphemism, it's a bathtub. Visitors surge in and recede like the ocean she never sees. For 80 minutes daily, the sun lights up the concrete courtyard.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Barbara Edelman. She's reading from her new chapbook entitled Exposure. So, Barbara, do you think you can sing that disco song again?
I could probably sing it better if I get to try again.
Oh, I thought it was great.
Thanks.
I was surprising, you know, and great. Nice poem.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the language in your work. I noticed in a number of poems, but I'm thinking of the tunnel poem that you started with, a lot of repetition in terms of words and phrases, but also a repetition of structure, you know, in the poem, you know. So repeating phrases. And I'm wondering if how you feel about that kind of attention to language. I mean, obviously all poets have that, but if you think of it as language as an actor in your poem, as almost a character, because it really feels, you know, present.
It's a hard question to answer. I'm not sure that I understand a language as a character. I think it's the most important thing for me in the poem. Though many of my poems, I think, are personal narratives, I think that I always choose on the side of the language that's more interesting to me. I think it's very important for me that it has, I guess it's the phrase imaginative truth. I think that's W.D. Snodgrass's phrase. But in terms of repetition, I do like using repetition. I love hearing repetition in poems, and I think I like it as long as it's not too predictable, right. As long as the repetition modulates and surprises in some way.
Yeah, no, it didn't seem predictable at all, but it also didn't seem seamless. It seemed like it stood out in the poem as almost a more active part of the poem than usual, whatever usual is, but you know what I mean? So that's why I guess I'm asking.
Oh, I think I understand you now, that you want to be aware of that repetition. It feels very deliberate as a chosen kind of a structure. Yeah, I think I wanted that to happen.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds that way from what you're saying.
Well, that particular poem is playing with the idea of obsession.
Okay.
It had this epigraph, obsession is the opposite of creativity. And, you know, many writers say that we write from obsession. So I began thinking a lot about that idea. And obsession suggests repetition to me in a way. I think that's partly why it was there structurally.
And who's that quote from?
It's from a friend of... a therapist that a friend of mine saw only once.
Well, that might have been worth the price of admission. That's a good
right.
quote, I thought. Okay, could you read some more?
Yes. My chapbook is entitled Exposure, and my original idea was to call every poem in it Exposure. But as it turned out, I have Exposure 1 and Exposure 2. This is Exposure 1. I was talking to a shrink about lack of focus. She said, here's an extreme example. A woman cleaning her house who stops scrubbing the kitchen to get a rag from the closet and from there sees she'd started dusting the bedroom and stopped to get cleaner from the kitchen. So she resumes dusting the bedroom, forgetting the kitchen, until she walks to the bathroom to dampen the dust cloth and sees the cabinet open and empty and remembers she'd been cleaning the cabinet when she went to the kitchen to get cleanser and noticed she'd been scouring the sink when... Well, in fact, the therapist said only a few of these words, and I plugged myself right in. I am that extreme example, I said, but are you sure it slows my cleaning? And she said, ah, but the woman cleaning is a metaphor, a capsule of actual behavior. Thus, literal speed of metaphorical cleaning is irrelevant. And I thought then of cleaning as metaphor for therapy, a monologue confined to one room within a circumscribed time, and would a portion of my brain be cleaner when I emerged? I thought of monologue as metaphor for type A cleaning, and of my more expansive style as dialogue among all rooms, which are rooms of the self, another shrink told me, when I dreamed the delicious dream of more and more rooms opening up off my one-room apartment. More space, I rejoiced, but he said no, more parts of the self, and I loved that too, my very selves as multiplying square footage. And then he said, more parts of Barbara. And when he did that third-person thing, I thought several things at once. Oh, God, he's one of those. If his face were gigantic, it would make an excellent climbing wall with well-placed crevices and ledges. Is he referring to some other Barbara? And if so, what's the point of extra rooms if I have to share? Algebra problem. The branches of bare sumac draw X's and Y's across a white sky, and I think of Algebra 2, the stroke upon stroke of wrong turns that multiplied how lost I got. My father sat down and worked with me. At 15, I started learning for the first time how to fail at learning and garner his rare attention. By year's end, I could barely add without a tutoring session. His desk was an oak door laid across file cabinets. His patience was a second door that swung into an unfamiliar room. He gripped a yellow pencil and, one scrap of paper at a time, unveiled to me equations inside the equations until I felt I could rebuild our house from its foundation up with those fleshless X's and Y's, my brief grasp of a universe fitting together, my father nearly reachable across a fence of numbers. Two weeks. White hydrangea, real ones my mother grew. Plastic vase, plastic diapers on the shelf. His face grows skeletal, arms still muscular. If I move, even his arm, he yells that he'll fall out of bed. A machine and two aides haul him bellowing into his wheelchair. I read him Saul Bellow, Faulkner. Get your car, let's go home. He's forgotten that he stopped walking, stopped standing. He's walking the edge of something in his barred bed. He's falling, right hand an enormous blossom, a blown-up float, sacred river. Say the first lines of Kubla Khan, Dad, his spine a drooping stem. He sees it's a test, rallies to the full punch. My father, the cooperative child, down to a sunless sea. Cover me, I'm cold. The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money wrapped up in a 5-pound note. I got him to recite it long after I'd learned it myself. He loved the sounds of nonsense verse, rhymes that are layered like birthday cakes, memory, mammary, mummery, caverns measureless to man. I read him Gimple the Fool, The Room, a cavern of demons. He fell asleep and I stopped and I watched, and he woke and I read and he slept and I stopped and he dreamed he was dead and he woke and said, I'm dead, and then keep reading.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Barbara Edelman. She's reading from her new chapbook entitled Exposure. You know, I really love the range of your poems from, you know, they're really funny to the poems of grief. And I love the shrink poem where the speaker is using that internal voice, like what the client is thinking. And I was thinking... I'm not sure I've read a poem where that happens, like the internal voice.
Oh, good.
You know, I thought that was great.
Oh, thank you.
And it's also something that we all do. It's like, you know, whether in a shrink's office or with someone else, we're thinking, yeah, right, well, are they talking about me? Are they talking about someone else? And all this internal dialogue. And I think you did such a great job with that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I want to backtrack just for a minute. To the West. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of West in your poems. You have the poem Go West, the mother poem, but you have the other poem where you're starting out with, what is it? We took disco lessons in Malibu or something. Can
right.
you talk about the role of the West in your writing or in this book?
Sure. I lived there for a long time, and yet I seem to be writing about it more recently than I did when I first moved. So I do go back quite a bit because I have family there. The landscape is so different. I'm very much of an outdoors person, and I'm very attached to the landscape here as well as the landscape there. And I think the physicality of the West is very important to me, the ocean and the mountains and the dry air. The culture was so different. I mean, I lived there during the 1980s. That's what the poem In Memory of Joel is about, which was, you know, an AIDS epidemic. And I also worked in the entertainment industry. So my whole life was very different in a way.
And you said just now you're starting to write those poems, or?
I'm writing more about the West recently. I'm not sure why. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of those things took a long time to germinate. I think sometimes when I miss a place very much, I start writing about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, I think they're strong poems.
Thank you.
And this also was struck by that line, you know, in your mother poems, but in the mother poem where it said, this was not her first migration, and I feel like there's a lot of exploration, movement in your work also. I mean, do you think that's a driving force for you as a writer?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important to me as a person, and it seems to keep coming up in my writing. When I lived in Los Angeles, it was kind of a cliche to write driving poems, so I was always embarrassed and tried to stifle writing any kinds of poems with driving. Finally, I think I allowed myself to do that, so I do have movement poems. I think maybe none of these was a driving poem, but I think that movement is a certain aspect of my personality that I never feel like I'm settled. I never feel like I quite know what I want to know, or and I also just enjoy exploration physically as well as mentally.
Okay. Can you read some more?
Yes. I feel like I'm reading a lot of downer poems, but this is a poem for a friend of mine who was a wonderful poet who died a year ago. Her name's Carol Hamilton. Email automatic reply. Out of office, hospice. How did the air change just then, she thought, and then lost the thought. The curdling light, the nervous screen, the ringing in her ears. Hard surfaces of tables spiked with metallic flecks. A public buzz from inside the light or inside the screen. Or maybe not a buzz at all, not a sound, but a flicker that feels like a buzz. He had a buzz cut, said Aaron yesterday, looming over her after class. So you'd think he'd be like some military guy, but he was like seedy. I mean, what do you mean, she said. I mean like seedy. Well, how did you know, she said. No. What about him was seedy, she said. Well, he was like, you know, his clothes were two sizes too big, and he pulled up his hood so you could barely see his face, and every crappy thing he had on was like black or some other non-color. What else, she said. He was walking around with a weed whacker, said Aaron. But that was yesterday. She's sliding away from today, detouring into buzz cuts and weed whackers and metallic flecks, into anything but the actual thing. Today is wet. This morning in Shakespeare, the students wanted badly to be sleeping, until she asked if they thought Bottom with his donkey head really wanted to eat those fairies, mustard seed and peas blossom, rather than befriend them. And then all of their faces lifted, the private sleepiness of each like a screen door sliding open, and they stared as if she were the dream, and what they wanted badly now was to waken away from her. In grad school, the seminar table always made her hungry. In Celia's story, she'd said, the Thanksgiving turkey is the dead father. And her classmates leveled her a similar stare, but the prof, a man older than God, said, of course, they're carving the dead father and eating him with cranberry sauce. But that's much further back than her earlier tangent, much further from the now of an hour ago that she's been sitting on like a bruise. This afternoon, in the wobbly light, in the inner ear ringing of a phone or doorbell that will not stop ringing, at the hesitant screen, in the sickly light, the sidewalks wet through arched windows. She scrolled by a subject line like something blinking red on a mountain road through fog and kept scrolling, didn't stop to open, thinking, maybe that's the name of an article Carol's sending, or maybe it's one of her grim jokes, and then thinking, no, she doesn't do that anymore. Exposure 1. The hematologist wants to freeze us. 60 minutes in this public refrigerator, the blood stops moving. For the first time, I connect two meanings of the word patient. My mother's shirt's inside out. Your teeth are so white, she says loudly. Now the other hypothermic patients have something to do. Pretend they're not listening. She's lost her artificial tears. I hand her mine, and she knocks back a shot in each eye. What did you pay for these? I get mine for 89 cents at Walmart. No one else is talking now. We look out through glass walls at baked asphalt. Enter a woman with a stroller. A boy? How wonderful, says my mother. How much does he weigh? What did he weigh at birth? I could be 12 again, 6, 19. A girl smashing glass inside a statue of a girl sitting perfectly still. Let's wait outside, she says. I give her my arm. The sun hits us like a shovel. Ducks waddle at the edge of the asphalt, then a square carved pond like a dead TV screen. A forest of poplars once grew here. I conjure them, numerous, immense, casting layers of undulating shade. My mother sighs. She feels them too. Girl in a coonskin cap, circa 1953, for Carrie. Only her sneakers face the camera. She's 3, poised for a stump speech on a flipped bucket, a heart sewn into the bib of her overalls. The plump cheeks beam. Fantastic animal hairdo. It lifts her 3 inches. The striped tail adorns her shoulder like she's just grown it. All around the outskirts of a Michigan town she'll later dub Bland Vapids, the Flatlands. Her body swivels west, toward the Rockies she's just invented in all their strata, down to the 3-billion-year-old core. Then east, toward the Appalachians, whose white mists rise out of gorges like sketches of lives she might one day muscle into color. So much to investigate and dissect. Before the classroom's sealed windows and its infant crawl toward afternoon, toward the far edge of the 50s. The frontiers are out there, in the narratives of arrowheads and bones, the alternating currents of the brain, the body's sweet topography. Mick Jagger, thank God, is not far around the corner. And Grace Slick will arrive at the White House for Trisha Nixon's Fisk alumnae tea, hiding 600 micrograms of acid to spike the president's drink. Meanwhile, the sky is a milk-based soup. Behind the baby face, so full of appetite and savvy, chicken wire rises to the height of her cap, then a long block of barracks like a stuck train, then phone poles, a line of double crosses.
It's the poetry of Barbara Edelman. Thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment Newsweekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.